This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 511, I think. If I've got my counts correctly, I think we're like 9 weeks. 9 weeks away from 10 years worth of podcasts. Oh, so ridiculous. Because it'll be episode 520 in 9 weeks. And it will be a little warmer then, which is great. See, in 9 weeks, that'll be about Leprechaun Day, too, as well. So that'll be coming up. And I think I'm going to do a little something for Valentine's Day this year. Well, for the morning after Valentine's Day, since it's close. And then, like, next year, Friday is going to be on Valentine's Day. So I'll have to do something for that as far as dressing up and going to Walmart. It's been a good week. It's been a good week. Big week. Maybe it wasn't big for anybody else, but we closed December this week, which means we closed the year this week. So, yeah. Everything went fine. Which is good. We like it a lot when everything goes fine. It just all went fine. It was interesting. Tuesday night is when we closed, and I think I mentioned that, you know, we were going to be doing a lot of summarized documents, and we had never pushed the system that hard before, and I was fairly confident that we were going to be okay, but you never know till it does it, and blah, 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 blah. And I went out with dinner with a friend on Tuesday, and so we talked about that a little bit, talked about a bunch of other stuff. And dropped him back at his house, I don't know, about 6:30. And my first check, I wasn't going to be until 8:30, 8:45 or so to see where we were. And, you know, so now I got 2 hours that I got to wait. 2 hours to see if I'm going to be hauling in and working for a good portion of the night or whether or not everything's fine. 2 hours. And I think I mentioned before that when we were running recurring this last time that they were practicing Little Drummer Boy. I decided I was just going to listen to it and enjoy it as opposed to being concerned about whether or not recurring was going to run. And so as I'm driving back home, well, the first thing I was thinking is when I was driving back home, I was like, you know, you need to be careful when you're driving, because if you had an accident, this would be a bad night to have an accident. So I was trying to be careful. But I thought, you know, I'm going to listen to Little Drummer Boy again. And so I hopped on my phone, and I actually found the arrangement that they did at church of Little Drummer Boy. It's by King and Country. So if you go out to YouTube and look for Little Drummer Boy, King and Country, it's a great arrangement. It's just so great. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Besides the fact that I really love that Christmas carol. So I was listening to that driving back home, and then, you know, I started doing some writing, had to take the trash out, got that taken care of, started doing some writing, and I just hunkered down, focused on the writing, and then finally about 8:30, I thought, I'm going to find out what's going on. And so I hopped on. We had made it through the summarization thing that I was concerned about. And, you know, I figured out where we were. We didn't do 30,000 pages. We only did 27,000 pages of receipts on Tuesday night. So, you know, and then just kept tracking it all the way out. About 11:15, 11:20 at night, I was able to bring up the dashboard to see if we balanced, and we balanced. Booyah! And you know, every day is a good day with Jesus, and every moment is a good moment with Him, but it's funner when you're actually looking at the dashboard and everything's green. It's like, yes, we are on this side of it. So it's been a good week. Been able to get a few other things done that needed to get done, and I think we're in pretty good shape for all that stuff coming in. I've been thinking about Star Wars Day. It's not actually on a Friday, but it's close enough. Star Wars Day, May the 4th, is actually on a Saturday this year. But I thought, I found a cute t-shirt, and I thought, let's do this. So I've been kind of working on that here and there as well. And writing, and the writing's going fine. Got a bunch of details. I'm not sure how they're going to work out, but, you know, it's just amazing. I was, this is the first full week I have of going into the sprint, and I had done my read-through, and everything was great, and yet, at the same time, you know, wasn't really sure where we were starting, but I sat down Sunday, and, you know, looked at what I had done before, and whoops, hit the brake a little too hard there. Looked at what I had done before, and I was like, nope, this last section I was working on, I'm talking about this too early, this needs to be shoved later in the book, and then, okay, no, we need to go to this character, and then that needs to happen, and then it just opened up. So, it's so amazing. That process is so amazing that what happened there then begins to open up in other areas. It's just amazing to watch that all unfold. I mailed out the books this week, the production copies of book 9 for people who had left a review on Amazon. And, you know, it's just amazing. One of my people I sent a book to said, man, we've got to sit down and talk about creativity somehow, and how in the world do you keep pushing these books out? And I had another friend say, you know, we're going, I'm on a schedule. But I was reading about some other authors as well, and sure enough, you know, their secret was being on a schedule. They had a schedule and said, this is how much I'm going to write today, this is how much I'm going to write today, and then you sit down and you do it. And it's just, it's like the children of Israel crossing the Jordan River, you know? Back when they came out of Sinai, the waters parted and then they went across. But when they hit the Jordan, the feet of the priest had to hit the water first, and then poof, it happened. And that's the way it is with creativity for me. Something gets scheduled, I have to sit down and actually start doing it, and then magic happens. So it's fun. It's fun. I'm a few words behind today, but that's okay. I was tired last night, and I had to do something last night that chewed up some extra time. I don't know what it was, but so I'm a few words behind, but that's fine. I'll get caught up. I'm close. I'm within striking range of having my 10,000 words this week. And all is well with the family. Everybody's recovering from stuff. So we're all good. All is well. God is kind, gracious, beauteous to us. I was thinking, I was working away, and at one point I had some kind of brainless work that I just had to slog through. So I went to Amazon Prime and opened up my music on there and found Little Drummer Boy by King and Country. So I was listening to that again, and I was thinking, you know, this is it. I mean, really, what are we going to bring to him? Really? Money? He doesn't need our money. You know, we're going to live our lives. We're going to drum. You know, we're going to be what we can be for him. I played my best for him. So it's fun. Okay, anyways, I came across an article, and when I read this article, I thought, and it's interesting because I think this is very insightful, and I think this guy is dead on. as to what's going on in the media today, and maybe we just don't want to admit it yet. But I think he's dead on. His name was Derek Thompson. This was published in The Atlantic. And the subtitle, well, the title is "The Media's Post-Advertising Future is Also Its Past." So this was published on December 31st, 2018. This guy is a staff writer for The Atlantic. I think I've said that. And the subtitle was "Why the News is Going Back to the 19th Century." This is really interesting. So he says, "It's my holiday tradition to bring tidings of discomfort and sorrow to my colleagues in the news business." So apparently, he writes one of these articles every year about the doom and gloom that's coming. He said, "One year ago, I discussed the media apocalypse coming for both digital upstarts and legacy brands. Vice and BuzzFeed had slashed their revenue projections by hundreds of millions of dollars, while the New York Times had announced a steep decline in advertising." Said 12 months later, it's the end times all over again. There have been layoffs across Vox Media, Vice, and BuzzFeed, and dubious talk of an emergency merger. Mick, once valued at $100 million, fired most of its staff and sold for $5 million. Verizon took a nearly $5 billion write-down on its digital media unit, which includes AOL and Yahoo. Reuters announced plans to lay off more than 3,000 people in the next 2 years. The disease seems widespread, affecting venture capital darlings and legacy brands, flattening local news while punishing international wires. Almost no one is safe, and almost everyone is for sale. News. It's a tough time to be in the news business. You know, he talks about the fact that he said it's tempting to think that this is the inevitable end game when it comes to the duopoly of Google and Facebook, that it's all over. But he said if you look at four different trends, you might see that there is another route, that it's more complex than that. And there might be a convergence coming about where there is a different path forward. So he said the first trend that we've got is there's too many players. So that it's not just Facebook and Google. So just about every rich big tech company is talking about selling ads. So everybody wants to sell ads. Meaning that just about every big tech company may be another competitor in the fight for advertising revenue. And, I mean, you know, Google obviously is king in a lot of this, and Facebook is obviously king in a lot of this, but AT&T is building an ad network, Uber is reportedly trying to get in there, you know, Snapchat, Pinterest, all of them are trying to do that. That's first big trend. There's too many players in the ad business. Second big trend is there's not enough quote-unquote saviors. I didn't know this, but he was talking about the fact that everybody thought that the iPad was going to be one of the saviors of news, that people would just read their news and they would, you know, be great. And there's a bunch of others that he mentions that were supposedly going to come out and save the news, and he said none of them have really panned out. He said the third big trend is that there's really no playbook moving forward. He said news organizations are experimenting with anything and everything. For the past 2 years, many newspapers and magazines have reoriented their business around subscriptions, asking readers to make up revenue lost from advertisers. Some magazines and papers, including The Atlantic, and The Correspondent are asking diehards to become not just subscribers, but members who pay a premium to go deeper with their favorite journalists. He names a bunch of other people, have, you know, TV studios, they've sold shows to Netflix and HBO. BuzzFeed, I didn't know this. BuzzFeed is opening a store in New York City and selling kitchen merchandise with Walmart. Because, you know, they're scrambling. News is scrambling. In this era of ubiquitous content, where everybody's a content creator, and all you need to do to create content is to go out, you run into a fence and take a picture of it, and you can put it on Instagram. They did mention an interesting statistic he did as well, that the number of local reporters today is at its lowest point since the 1970s, despite the fact that the U.S. population has grown by 50%. That's interesting. Anyway, so third trend is that there's no clear playbook for how to move forward. News organizations are scrambling, trying to figure this out. And the fourth trend is patronage with varying levels of beneficence. So, he says in here, many legacy titles have already landed with millionaires and billionaires, including Time, which was bought by Mark Benioff, the founder of Salesforce. Fortune, bought by Chachaval. Oh man, Giravavanan. Thai businessman, The Washington Post, owned by Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, etc. But he says the problem with that is that a patron is just a person, so if he changes his mind, he said Chris Hughes recently junked the New Republic when losses eclipsed his idealism. Phil Anschutz snuffed out the Weekly Standard. Michael Bloomberg has made noises about selling off his political desk if he runs for president. So the guy in the article says, it's safe to say that going forward, media organizations will get by on some combination of subscriptions, patronage, and auxiliary revenue from sources such as events or licensed content. Whatever happens, advertising will almost certainly play a lesser role. And that's really the key point in this article, and I thought was so insightful and really puts this in a historical context that then starts to get interesting. And I think has already done this, whether purposely or instinctively or intuitively. And that is, he says, that to understand the future of post-advertising media, let's briefly consider its past. During a period of the early 19th century, one moment, I'm getting my mail. A special gift just for us. Okay, during a period of the early 19th century, known as the party press era, newspapers relied on patrons. These patrons were political parties. Hence, party press, that handed out printing contracts to their favorite editors or directly paid writers to publish vicious attacks against rivals. Read that and went, wow, this sounds familiar. That era's journalism was hyper-political and deeply biased, but some historians believe that it was more engaging. Here we go. It was more engaging. The number of newspapers in the United States grew from several dozen in the late 1700s to more than 1,200 in the 1830s. These newspapers experimented with a variety of journalistic styles and appeals to the public. As Gerald J. Baldassi, a professor at the Washington University, has argued, these newspapers treated readers as a group to engage and galvanize. Perhaps as a result, voting rates soared in the middle of the 19th century to record highs. It was advertising that led to the demise of the party press. Ads allowed newspapers to become independent of patronage and to build the modern standards of, quote, objective journalism. Advertising also led to a neutered, that's an interesting word for it, neutered, detached style of reporting. The, quote, view from nowhere, quote, to avoid offending the biggest advertisers, such as department stores. Large ad-supported newspapers grew to become the profitable behemoths, but they arguably emphasized milquetoast coverage over more colorful reader engagement. That's a very interesting, more colorful reader engagement. What does that mean? Milquetoast coverage. That's an interesting phrase, too. So, are we saying that objective, fair reporting is milquetoast and not as colorful? But now, see that the ad revenues are dropping. Journalism could be more political again, but also more engaging. That's already happened. Yes, it has. For example, in just the last few decades, the New York Times' revenue has shifted from more than 60% advertising to more than 60% reader payments. As its business model has changed, so has its coverage. Quote, this is from the late James L. Bauman, the communication theorist and University of Wisconsin professor. Quote, look at the New York Times in 1960 versus 2010. The reportage is more interpretive. Well, again, that's a nice euphemistic term for it. It's more interpreted. The author of this article says, mid-century newspapers were as broad and unobjectionable as department stores because department store advertising was their business. News media of the future could be as messy, diverse, and riotously disputatious as their audiences, because directly monetizing them is the new challenge of the news business. Said, every once in a while someone asks me whether we'll ever get back to the place where the country can agree on a single set of facts, quote unquote. Those asking the question tend to be nostalgics for the 1950s, when they could count the number of television channels on one hand and rely on Walter Cronkite and the local media monopoly to control the form of information. This is how he concludes. That past is dead and irrecoverable. We've accelerated backward as if in a time machine, whizzing past the flush 20th century to move to a more distant, more anxious, and just maybe more exciting past that is also the future. Again, that's a very nice euphemistic way to put it. What he's saying, and what I think we have obviously, at least in my mind, obviously seen, is that what we will have, what we have now, and what we will have in the future, is blatantly biased news reporting. Whether it's on the conservative side, or on the liberal side, whether it's on the far right or the far left, it will be blatantly biased. The facts will be picked and chosen in whatever way supports what the person is trying to say. You are going to have major news organizations that are going to be doing this because they know their readership. And if their readership is more liberal and leans to the left, they are going to do everything they can to keep those subscriber dollars. So that means they may still trumpet the fact that they're fair and unbiased reporting, but they're not, because they have to appeal to their base. They have to, because advertising revenues is down. This is just normal and natural. As I'm fond of saying, once an entity becomes aware of its own existence, there is one first principle that eclipses all others. How do I continue to exist? And how news organizations are going to continue to exist is by playing to their base, which means they will do whatever they have to do to nitpick, to skew facts, to run their statistics that agree with them, because that's their job. They have to get clicks. They have to get subscribers in, because the ad revenue is just being destroyed by all of these players in the market. And that's, when I read this article, I was like, well, yeah, that's what's happening. So I don't think there's anything to be upset about here. You know, yes, there may be trumpeting about how we're, you know, fair and unbiased, but it's just not true. It's just not true. Because that kind of thing just doesn't exist anymore. So anytime you're reading any kind of article, you can just count on the fact that it's going to come from a bias. It's like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with the Washington Post printing an opinion page called "Why Can't We Hate Men?" I mean, it's an extremely biased article, but it doesn't matter. They're playing to their base because they have to. They know their subscriber base, and they have to play to that. Because if they don't, they can't exist. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.